From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. The Trump administration has pulled the United States out of the Paris Climate Agreement. It's also dumped the so-called Clean Power Plan. But we'll chat with a climate expert who says there's no reason to worry. It's no shock when Democrats complain about the way Republicans run the North Carolina General Assembly, but we'll highlight one instance in which the complaint is spot on target. Can a college campus have both free speech and safe spaces? A Wake Forest University professor says yes. You'll hear his explanation. And we'll talk about the two known candidates for North Carolina's 2018 state Supreme Court election. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Medicaid accounts for 16% of spending in North Carolina's general operating budget. The Behemoth program, which is a joint program of the federal government and the states, will cost North Carolina taxpayers roughly $3.7 billion for the 2017-18 fiscal year. In mid-November, we learned that the Medicaid system in our state, once notorious for running over budget, will now be staying within its budget and doing it for the fourth year in a row. Dan Way is associate editor of Carolina Journal. He covers health care for the paper and the website, and he joins us now to talk about this news. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you, Donna.
Considering the history of Medicaid in North Carolina for years and years and years up until recently, this really is amazing news.
Well, it really is. When the McCrory administration first took office, they held a press conference almost immediately describing the travails of the system. I mean, it was $2 billion underfunded for about 4 years running. There were contracts that people couldn't account for. There was lax administrative oversight. It was just totally chaotic, and there's been a very systematic approach since that time with the Republican-controlled legislature to rein that in and make it more accountable.
Now, even though it will be within the budget for another year, this program actually is growing. Why is that?
Well, it's always growing. I mean, the state's growing. The population's growing. It's just part of it's just natural growth. Some of it's programmatic. Sometimes the legislature tweaks different programs that will allow more people to gain coverage. But interestingly, we also noted that 26 counties have not increased enrollment growth in the recent past.
Really?
So the thinking there might be that the economy is improving, jobs are more available, people are working now and don't require this social safety net.
And that gets me to my next question. Help us understand Medicaid. Really, what's the profile of the person who is covered by Medicaid?
Well, there are a range of programs. There are a range of people who are covered. So it's basically you think of it as the poor, the aged, blind, and disabled, children, single mothers.
I mentioned at the top, Dan, that it's going to cost North Carolina taxpayers $3.7 billion for the current fiscal year, but the feds provide money for this as well. So this is a much larger, more expensive program than even that.
Right. The federal program, I believe, contributes about 60% to the total spending. So it's much more than what the state provides.
So this is a huge number of people. Do we have a sense of about how many people in North Carolina are covered by the program?
Yes, we do. In fact, that's growing. Last year it was about 1.9 million people, and this year it's slightly over 2 million. So it's a little over a 3% increase in the enrollment.
Considering that we have about 10 million people or so in this state, that is a huge number.
Very big.
By the program. So the budget is essentially stabilized, even though the program is growing, and predictability, as folks have always said, that was an important factor for this. So that seems to be relatively under control, but there are changes coming to this program, Dan. You've been writing about them at CarolinaJournal.com. Let's talk first about what's known as integrated care. What's happening?
Well, the way that services are presently administered, You have two different systems. One that works for physical care, persons' bodily issues. The other one is behavioral health care, mental illness, substance abuse, things of those nature. They've been operating under two separate systems. So you have all your duplication of services, and not services, but administration and so forth. You have two different systems. So under integrated care, they will put those two systems under one umbrella so that the person gets complete care, comprehensive care, and the physician will know better how to address the whole person rather than having people in different areas.
And potentially two sets of treatment doctors and nurses, et cetera,
right,
not really knowing specifically what the other group is doing.
Right. So when you look at integrated care, there may be physical issues that are associated with mental health and vice versa that won't get necessarily addressed if you have two separate systems. So when you put those under one roof, the doctors will know the whole history of the person and how best to treat them.
Fiscally, Dan, do we know if going to integrated care will have any ramifications for the budget, or do they think maybe that saves any money at all, or is it strictly about just trying to have a better care, better outcome for the patient?
Well, certainly if they have better care and better outcomes, that should save money in and of itself.
Because they are accessing care less, presumably.
Right. So this whole switch and removing into managed care, the whole notion of that is for better outcomes. Right now we have a fee-for-service system which pays the providers for every visit, every procedure, every prescription, and that can be very costly. So switching to managed care, they will instead have a capitated rate, which means there's a ceiling on it. And a physician or the provider group will get a set amount, a flat fee every month, and they will have to find a way to provide all those services. And then they will be judged on whether or not the outcomes are better. So that in itself is a driver for moving costs down.
And that is a big change. And in fact, among members of the legislature, they're not monolithic on what they think about this. Some people think it's a good idea. Some don't. Help us understand what some of the conversation is among those legislators.
Well, there's still the discussion about whether or not to move to managed care, because that will have the people who would deliver those services generally will be big insurance companies, corporate entities. And so some people don't like that notion. They think that that for-profit entry into the healthcare market is not a good idea. On the other side, people say, well, look, we've been doing this public stuff forever. Costs are not coming down. Things aren't improving. So if we move to this other system, we'll have more control. There will be metrics put in place, guidelines that people will have to meet. And so they'll have to come in under cost. And if they're not, it's a competitive bidding process for those people who get the contracts with the state. And if they're not meeting the demands put forth, then they risk losing the contract the next year.
And frankly, the patients will complain if they feel like they aren't getting the care that they believe that they deserve, going to the doctor. So that in and of itself could become a key factor whether patients are satisfied with the new process.
Right. So this is all patient-driven. That's the whole reason for this changeover.
Dan, with these changes, both going to integrated care and moving to managed care versus fee-for-service, what kind of timing are we talking about this? And can the legislature simply just make the decision to do this, or are there other entities since Medicaid is a federal-state program?
No, they can't just make the decision, nor can DHHS make the decision.
Which is the Health and Human
Services Department. So they will be submitting a waiver application to the federal government within the next few weeks. Hopefully they're looking at getting that approved by February, after which time they will put out requests for proposals from the different entities that would implement these broad networks, and possibly by sometime in 2019, mid-2019, launch the program.
So the first step, though, is getting that approval of a waiver from the federal government to make these changes at the state.
That's right. And all indications are at this point that the feds are looking very favorably on the plan.
Well, it is a fascinating story, and it affects every North Carolinian because taxpayers have a huge investment in this, and of course the patients do as well. Dan Way is covering healthcare for CarolinaJournal.com, and of course in the monthly print edition as well. Dan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us, much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The Trump administration pulled the United States out of the Paris Climate Agreement, and Trump's Environmental Protection Agency has nixed the Clean Power Plan, which was sold as a way to help address climate change. So with those major changes in policy, is the world now on its way to overheating? Joining us to help answer the question is Dr. Patrick Michaels. He's director of the Center for the Study of Science at the Cato Institute. He's also a climatologist and the author of Lukewarming, the New Climate Science That Changes Everything. Welcome back to the program.
Hey, Mitch. Well, my answer to you is the world is on its way to lukewarming, which is what it's been doing for quite some time, which means it's not warming up all that much.
We hear quite a bit about the dangers of climate change, and if the Trump administration makes these changes, we're going to be setting ourselves up for all kinds of problems in the future. Is there any truth to that?
Well, you can use the EPA's own model. It's called the Model for the Assessment of Greenhouse Gas-Induced Climate Change. And if the listeners are really clever, they'll realize the acronym for the model is MAGIC. And you can use the MAGIC model to see how much warming would be prevented if the United States dropped its emissions to zero and kept them there until the year 2100. And it's about 2 to 3 tenths of a degree Celsius. Now, that assumes an expected warming of over 3 degrees. That's wrong. It's not going to warm up that much because it's just not warming up that much. So the United States, yeah, we're a contributor, but on the flip side of this, absent any real attempt to reduce greenhouse gases and carbon dioxide, what nation on earth has reduced its emissions more than any other?
I think I have a guess, but I'm going to let you answer.
The good old USA. And that's because we've been substituting natural gas for coal for power generation. Natural gas is now much more efficient with regard to the cost of power generation, and it produces about half as much carbon dioxide per unit energy that you get out of it. What's not to like?
And these changes were not necessarily made because of any desire to reduce emissions.
No, they were made because of the desire for good old profit. You can produce power cheaper. You can produce power cleaner. You don't have to scrub out sulfate and nitrogen oxides out of the plant because natural gas doesn't burn to that. Coal has all these residuals in it. So, yeah, it's just people wanted to outcompete other people in the power market.
So the changes in policy that have been put in place since Donald Trump entered the White House will have no noticeable impact on the climate?
Paris would have had no noticeable impact anyway. If every country on earth does what they say they were going to do with Paris, and assuming more warming is forecast than is actually going to happen, the Paris Agreement would save around 2/10 of a degree C of warming globally. That's it. It doesn't do anything. And everybody knows it. And the only reason the Paris supporters claim that it would reduce emissions so much is they erroneously blame every last bit of warming since the Industrial Revolution on human beings. Everyone who studied this knows that's not so. That way they get an inflated savings figure. But really, the fact of the matter is we haven't warmed all that much.
We are chatting with Dr. Patrick Michaels at the Cato Institute, also the author of Lukewarming, the New Climate Science That Changes Everything. So we continue to hear, despite what you're just saying, that global warming or climate change, whichever term is used, is this long-term problem and we're just avoiding dealing with it and the United States is part of the problem. What's your response when people continue to make such a big deal about this?
The last scientific paper I presented, which was last month, to the Air and Waste Management Association, I showed that because we are going to be exporting so much natural gas and because countries in which the air is really dirty, like China, are becoming affluent. And as they become affluent, the people demand environmental protection. What's going to happen is there's going to be a large switch away from coal for power generation globally. And if you start adding up all the numbers, you realize that by the year 2100, we are going to warm less than the Paris Agreement would allow. In other words, we're going to meet the Paris Agreement with or without the Paris Agreement. And Donald Trump was perfectly right in saying this is a bad deal for the United States. After all, we're reducing our emissions anyway, and we want to export this technology to the world. It's good for us.
And these changes you're alluding to are happening because of economic changes and not because of government mandates.
Absolutely. And I will tell you that I keep on hearing these arguments that, oh, solar and wind are as cheap as fossil power. Well, they're not. If they were, people would be closing fossil power plants and putting in undependable wind. Wind doesn't blow all the time, but there are some places where wind power is good, like in North Texas where it blows all the time. And the sun doesn't shine all the time, so that power plant's not going to be real efficient either. The point of the matter is if it worked capable of competing with these other large, dense sources, it would be doing it, and it would be doing it without a push from the taxpayers.
One thing we often hear is about the consensus among scientists about global warming. You are a scientist and, in fact, a climatologist.
Correct.
Not just a scientist, but someone who actually has worked on these issues. What, if anything, is the real consensus about what's happening?
Oh, this is a great story. I hope we have enough time for this. It has been revealed that the climate models are all tuned, in other words, made to mimic the climate of the 20th century. This was not general knowledge. It came out in Science magazine, I guess about 9 or 10 months ago, and a big paper came out talking about model tuning and that we don't even know what's been done to the models, because the graduate students that work on these things don't take notes. But we do know this. Models are tuned to achieve what is called in this landmark paper an anticipated acceptable range of change. In other words, it's not the objective model that makes the forecast for global warming. It's the subjective modeler who decides what's right. I mean, go figure. We're going to base the world's energy policy? We're going to base people's lives on that? I hope not.
And so these are people who are basically have a reason to want to see some global warming who are building this into the model?
Of course. The problem is, you know, if the first model group ever says it's going to warm 3 degrees and they have a lot of prestige, nobody's going to come out with a model that says it's only going to warm 1 degree. Oh, by the way, there are 105 climate models in the UN's latest report, and 104 of them are wrong. One of them has got it right, and it doesn't show very much warming at all. And, you know, tell the special prosecutor, because it's the Russian model.
Uh-oh. Some sort of Russian collusion. So in the brief amount of time that we have left, if people hear continued commentary about the dangers of global warming, what do you want them to know?
Well, they're already turning it off. I mean, you can only tell people that the world's going to end so many times, and when they notice the sun keeps rising, they tend to discount these predictions. You know, we've had like three big hurricanes in 1 year. Well, no big deal. We went, 12 years without a Category 3 crossing a U.S. coast? I mean, climate changes, climate stays the same, and the warming rate we're on will get us about 1.5, 1.6 degrees by the end of this century.
Dr. Patrick Michaels, he is the director of the Center for the Study of Science at the Cato Institute. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mitch.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal Radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Members of the minority party often make extravagant claims about abuse of power by the majority in the North Carolina General Assembly. But sometimes the complaints are valid.
I hope that at some point we start to look at how we are now treating conference reports.
That's House Democratic Leader Darren Jackson. He applied his general concern about legislative conference reports to one specific case.
Section 4 of Senate Bill 656 is a perfect illustration. It eliminates the judicial primaries for every judgeship in North Carolina. That's a big deal by any measure. It was never in any previous version of Senate Bill 656 that I saw. It's not related to any previous version of 656. It's not been filed as a bill or offered as an amendment by any member of this body or the Senate, as best as I can tell. Eliminating judicial primaries was never worked on in regular committee with the opportunity to hear public input. And most importantly, the members of this body had no opportunities to make any amendments. Basically, leadership made a decision about what would be in Senate Bill 656. The rest of us have no say.
Jackson pointed to a specific state house rule that's supposed to block this type of action.
Rule 44B says that only matters that are disputed between the chambers shall be considered by the conferees, but it only operates if the Senate has a similar rule, which of course they don't. So it makes our rule absurd. It's not the way the Democrats used to do things. We did not bind ourselves to what the Senate's sense of fair play was back in the day. So my question is, why would we do so today? I've talked to people here much longer than I have been, lobbyists, legislators, and staff. All agree that conference reports have never been abused the way they are routinely abused now. What's the big deal, you say? The end justifies the means. Sometimes you just come in and want to get things done and not waste a lot of time. Well, the big deal is we adopt rules to protect all 120 of us. The rules give us all a voice and a role in that process. My role is sometimes to stand up and point out when you're abusing those rules. If a bill goes to conference and the House says A and the Senate says B, then we had a role in A. What's your role when the conference report comes back with C? That's what happened in this bill with elimination of judicial primaries. Four or five people made a decision. The rest of us are spectators. We're not representatives.
That's Darren Jackson, leader of the State House Democrats. He's raising concerns about the way Republicans used a recent legislative conference report. They used that report to help cancel all primary elections in North Carolina's 2018 judicial races. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we do. And that's not bluster. In a private survey of more than 250 North Carolina political insiders, 87% said we influence them either a great deal or a good amount. So while others talk and complain, we get to work providing research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse that is the envy of every other state. Our research has actually helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, and improve your access to doctors, the recipe for stability and a bright future. The John Locke Foundation, we're dedicated to making North Carolina first in freedom. We're dedicated to you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Should college campuses support unfettered free speech, or should they create so-called safe spaces for students? Is this an either-or issue? Wake Forest University professor James Otteson offered an interesting response during a recent university forum.
Notice we didn't say free speech versus safe spaces, but that's actually how people often think of it and how they talk about it, that there's a conflict between the two. Here's how I would put that. The university's job is to create a safe space for free speech. That's what it is. We all operate in lots of different communities. So I'm a professor, I'm a husband, I'm a father. We all have these different roles. We have different communities that we're parts of. Even though we're individual people, we have these different communities. And sometimes there are different norms that apply to the different communities. What goes on at a university? Think about the lives of students. So you come out of, you're a minor, you're living with your parents or under the tutelage of somebody. What do your parents or your guardians, what do they do the whole time you're growing up? They're telling you what to do. My children can attest. Right? We tell you what to do. You can do this, you got to do this, here's your bedtime. Just about everything we're telling you what to do. When students graduate from college, what are they going to do then? They're going to get a job. And wherever they get a job, what's going to happen? They're going to get told what to do. This is the period where they get to explore. So I think the job of a main job of a university is to create a safe space for free speech.
Like other communities, Otteson says a university should provide students with a bedrock that they can count on.
What should the university provide its students that they can count on? What I think we should say to every student is, whatever your background, wherever you come from, whatever beliefs you have, we are going to value you as an individual and as a person regardless of whatever crazy ideas you get into your head. We are still going to value you. We are going to listen to you. We are going to respect you. And we're going to value you. Once we say that, now what we can say is, now go take risks with your thoughts. Once students understand, and we make a credible case, I think, and that's not easy, it's easier said than done, but we make a credible case to all of our students that, yes, this is a space where we are not going to hold your crazy idea that you're going to entertain for 5 minutes against you forever. We're not going to judge you. So I sometimes have to tell my students, you know, they think that if I give them a, you know, the grade I give you on your paper is my judgment of you as a moral person. No, it's just a grade on a paper. We're not going to judge you as a person, your humanity based on some idea that you're going to entertain here. Once we can credibly say that to students, then I think what we can demand of students is now take risks. Now is the time when it's okay for you to go ahead and contemplate and talk about and debate all of the ideas that you're not going to be able really to talk about ever again. The rest of your life you're going to spend still having to constrain yourself because you're working or you have these other responsibilities. Here is the time. So I think we should not think of these things as in contest, free speech and safe spaces. I think we should see them as being complementary.
That's Wake Forest University economist James Otteson speaking at a recent conference in Winston-Salem. He offered more observations about the value of free speech.
We often are afraid of ideas and perspectives we don't know anything about. And if the only familiarity we have with views that are different from ours is what we got from Twitter or from a blog post, then we don't really understand those ideas. And so we can envision all sorts of monsters and demons in our minds. One of the things that's important, I think, about the safe space for free speech is to defang and demystify different views. Encountering different views don't hurt you. Are we going to talk about violence in speech? They don't hurt you the way violence can. They might be uncomfortable, but I think the mind is like a muscle. It needs to be exercised and stretched. In order for it to grow, it needs to be exercised and stretched. And I think if we fear or are afraid of ideas that are different from ours, then that's going to cause all sorts of barriers, and in the end, we'll be the losers for it.
When, if ever, does speech step over the line? When is it unacceptable on campus?
We can imagine, if you imagine a spectrum, disinterested provision of information on the one hand, so verbal information, that doesn't bother anybody, violence or coercion or attacks on the other end. So the question is, where does that, on that continuum, does speech get to sort of the tipping point? Maybe, if not violence, incitement to violence? I think people of good faith can have differing views about that. What I would say is, so, and maybe I have a higher tolerance for hearing different views having gone to the University of Chicago. So when I was at Chicago, I've told some of my students this. When I was a brand new graduate student at the University of Chicago, the practice then as now is that if you're a PhD student and you've written a dissertation, the last thing you do before you get your degree is you have a public defense of your dissertation. Just think about that now. A public defense. Anybody can go. So I attended one of a graduate student who was in my department and who had gotten her. I was new and she was on her way out. And that was the most harrowing experience. I don't know how she made it out of that experience. I thought it was horrible the way they treated her. Calling her confused and maybe she wasn't up to the task and can she really even understand the words she herself is writing? And I mean, they said things like that, which I thought, well, holy cow, why did they let her get this far? If they really had that opinion of her, why they let her? And they passed her. Yeah, they passed her because, well, this is just what we do at Chicago. Okay. Well, if that's your experience, well, then you learn to adapt to something like that. Not everybody has an experience like that. Now, you asked about targeting people. So let's think about that. When people target other people. So here's something. You know, the Chicago principles distinguish between, they say we are willing to potentially punish conduct, but we're not willing to punish speech. That presumes a kind of bright line between the two. But is some speech actually an incitement or tantamount to conduct? Here's my, again, philosophical answer to that. It depends. I think that there is no single principle or single mechanical rule that will allow you to adjudicate that in every case. I think sometimes you need to have good judgment. Are there cases in which what people are saying are flirting with or going over the line of not just talking about ideas, but actually incitement to violence? There are. Will we always agree on what those are? No. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't think about them, and there will be cases where people of good faith disagree. So I think, in my view, we should err on the side of letting people speak, unless it's clearly a case where it's leading to incitement to violence. And one way that I'll give you one example to think about this. Some of you may know a woman named Ayaan Hirsi Ali, Somali former Muslim activist. I heard her speak once, and this is what she said. So she gives talks about Islam and women and its treatment of women. And that's very controversial, as you might guess. And she gets death threats. And what she says is, here's the difference. She says, I often hear people say to me, I hate you and I hope you die. That's okay. Then sometimes she hears, I hate you and I'm going to kill you. That's not okay. Now, sometimes it's not clear where one is almost the other and not, okay. So do you want to hear people say things like, I hate you and I hope you die? No. No, you don't. But if we have a safe space for free speech, then even odious speech like that, I think, is going to have to be tolerated until it becomes that other speech.
That's James Otteson of Wake Forest University. He's discussing the conflict or compatibility of free speech and safe spaces on college campuses. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Full color throughout every issue, more visual storytelling. We've revamped Carolina Journal to make it easier to read, a new look and a new feel. But one thing hasn't changed, and it never will. That is our commitment to truth and transparency in government. You can still count on Carolina Journal for investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, and vetting of corruption. No, our mission to shine the light on what North Carolina government and the bureaucrats who run it are doing in your name and with your money will never wane. And because of that, our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our distribution outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians every month. So make sure you stay informed. Read the monthly print edition of Carolina Journal. Then check in several times a day at carolinajournal.com. That's where you'll find fresh stories, opinion pieces, and updates on government, politics, and your money. Carolina Journal, we hold government accountable to you. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Next November, North Carolina voters will choose a member of the North Carolina Supreme Court. So far, two people are in that race, the person who currently holds the seat, Republican Justice Barbara Jackson, and Democrat Anita Earls, an attorney who leads the Southern Coalition for Social Justice. Carolina Journal will be covering this race as well as all of the races for 2018 quite intensively. Rick Henderson joins us now with a look at this particular race. Rick, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Donna.
First of all, there's been a lot of talk at the General Assembly about changing the way that we elect judges and justices in North Carolina. Kind of give us a sense of where we are.
Okay. Right now, the Senate is considering whether or not it's going to move toward some sort of change in the election process for judges and justices. If we're going to go to a system that some call merit-based or appointment-based system, if we're going to keep the current system in place, or if we're going to there's a constitutional amendment that has been proposed by the chairman of the Rules Committee in the House and the Senate that would essentially put every judicial race up on the ballot next year and convert all the judicial terms to two-year terms. That seems to me as much as anything to be a placeholder, something to get people scared to say, well, look, they're really going to do something that's going to change next year about this. But as of now, as the way things stand right now, we're going to have normal order next year, and we will have one justice on the Supreme Court whose term will be up, and that's Barbara Jackson's, and she will be running for reelection.
And there are seven members of the North Carolina Supreme Court,
that's right.
And it is her seat that is up. So we know right now we have the two people who've announced at this point. What do we know about Justice Jackson?
She's This will be the first time that she has stood for re-election on the court. She was elected in 2010. She served a term on the Court of Appeals before that. She is a Republican. There was an academic study that was done early part of this decade attempting to determine the sort of the ideological stance of the judges and justices in the appellate courts in North Carolina. And she came out as actually the most conservative of the justices. She was someone who worked in the Martin administration in its final days and also served in private practice and but has been very active in the judicial community in North Carolina for the better part of, I guess, 25 years now.
And I believe she's also been appointed by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court to a particular committee, I believe, on the administration of law and justice.
Yes.
So she's involved in that, taking a look at the system.
That's correct. So she's a very, very high-profile member of the judiciary in North Carolina and somebody who's very well-respected.
Now, the second person in this race at this point is Anita Earls. Anita Earls is an attorney with the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, and she has a rather high profile because she's been involved in several different public policy issues of late.
Right. She's one of the lead attorneys for the folks who are challenging the congressional districts and legislative districts in North Carolina on racial grounds. She is someone who is also with the Southern Coalition for Social Justice for the longest time was essentially a one-person operation. It was her. And she was someone who has been involved. She was with the UNC Center for Civil Rights. She was involved with all sorts of different sort of racial and social justice-oriented organizations and started this organization because she wanted to be able to combine all the actions of litigating and advocating for social services and advocating for voting rights and all sorts of things like that all in one shop, if you will. And so that's why she's running that center. She also was on the State Board of Elections for a while as well and was one of the people who urged a criminal investigation of former Governor Mike Easley.
Now, she also is advocating for a change in how North Carolina elects members of Congress, and this has gotten a lot of attention, this proposal. Tell us about it.
Right. She wrote an article that was published in The Nation magazine back at the end of June in which she wanted to switch the way that we elect members of Congress nationwide from a single member districts to a form of proportional representation somewhat or a weighted voting system. And the way that this would work would be if you were in a state that had six or fewer congressional seats, then all of the seats would be elected at large statewide. And if you were in a state that had more than that, then there would be either three, four, or five districts depending on how many geographical districts, depending on how large your congressional delegation was. This was in form of legislation that was introduced. And her argument is that gerrymandering is impossible to overcome in redistricting. And as long as we have the current system of first past the post plurality winner of races, one person from each geographic district, and that's all that goes in. As long as it continues, we're going to continue to have problems with underrepresentation by minorities. And so this is her answer to that system.
North Carolina has 13 congressional districts.
Right.
So under that proposal, 13 districts would shrink to
three. Right.
Interesting. And so she says she wants to do this because it would be more fair.
She says it would be more representative of members of different racial and ethnic minorities.
Now, as I mentioned, this has gotten a lot of attention. It's considered to be rather controversial.
Mm-hmm.
For those who oppose this idea, what essentially is the nut of their argument?
Well, the main thing that they talk about is the fact that with this system that we have right now, the districts have to be roughly equal in population, and because there's a fixed number of members of the House of Representatives and therefore a fixed delegation for each state, then each member represents about 750,000 people, let's say. And and because of that, they also have to be geographically somewhat tighter, supposed to be at least. That's one of the principles there. And so you will have people who are represented in an area who essentially have someone who is supposed to be reflective of their interests, someone who is a neighbor, someone who actually belongs to their community. And under the system that's proposed by Anita Earls, that wouldn't necessarily be the case. One of these districts would stretch all the way from the northeastern corner of the state through Charlotte.
So, oh, my. That's a huge swath of North Carolina.
I mean, there was an incredible amount of controversy back in the most recent congressional redistricting when G.K. Butterfield of the 1st District, whose district ran from, again, the northeastern corner of the state all the way into Durham County. And there was just uproar about the fact that, you know, what do voters in Durham have in common with voters in Elizabeth City, for instance? But this would make this – this would put this sort of system on steroids, if you will, because you would have – one district that essentially covered the southern third of the state, one that would southeastern third of the state, let's say, one that would cover the northern third of the state, and a third that would cover the southwestern part of the state. And so, it would be a very, very strange way of doing things. It would not be unconstitutional, by the way, because Congress, this can be changed by statute, but it's something that would certainly make it possible, in her view, for someone who, say, won 17% of the vote in a multi-candidate election to go to Congress, which would be a real change.
This would be a fascinating conversation that I suspect is going to be ahead as we get into 2018. And right now, Barbara Jackson is the current seat holder on the North Carolina Supreme Court. It is her existing seat that is up for election. Anita Earls challenging her. Rick, is it possible more people will be in this race?
It's always possible, but Anita Earls has already gotten the endorsement of former Governor Jim Hunt of the State Democratic Party. And so unless other things come out that she's written that make her a little more radioactive for mainstream Democrats, then these may be the two main candidates we see.
We've been talking with the editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal, Rick Henderson. We hope you'll listen again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.